So the easy one is this first one. Who's familiar with this top model, this accretion model of hydration of the Earth?
That's the easy one?
That's the easy one.
Oh, okay.
That's the easy one. You guys understand hydration of the Earth, right? The Big Bang Theory, whatever it is. Don't ask me to explain it, but ultimately a large bang. And then the coalescing of matter into pretty much everything that we see around us. One of the problems with that is simply, how did the Earth get hydrated? How do you get water on the Earth? Right? It's a fundamental problem that nobody ever bothers to think about too much, but you got to get water on the Earth to make life possible in the first place. So Darwin's theories don't work without water. And how do you get, I'll make the problem worse. Has anybody ever heard of the snow belt? I had not. I had to look it up. I was actually doing some background on a series of classes that I may or may not ever get to, since apparently I'm not making any progress. It is a circumference around any star in which moisture cannot naturally exist. It can't just float in the ether someplace as frost or ice or something else, and it's just because it's too close to the star, right? It would immediately be destroyed. And our planet is inside what's called that snow belt, meaning water cannot exist within the circumference around our sun in which we exist. So the question becomes, again, how did we get water on this planet to begin Darwin's theories for the formation of life? And the answer is, don't worry, asteroids. We have seen asteroids hit other planets. We have extracted matter from other asteroids that show signs of water or component parts of water. And so we just got pummeled by asteroids for a sufficient period of time to deposit the oceans of the world. Except, didn't work on the moon, and we know it gets pelted by asteroids all the time. And it didn't work on Mars, and it didn't work on, it's never worked anywhere else. And the amount of asteroids that you'd have to pummel the world with to get an ocean out of it, amazing, right? But that is the prevalent. I mean, I'm being sarcastic because I can't help it. It's just dumb. That is the prevalent scientific model for the hydration of the Earth. So much so that recently we've discovered that there are amazing reservoirs of water below the Earth. Now, that doesn't shock any of you because you're familiar with the Genesis account of the flood, where the deeps were opened, right? And so if you've read anything about that before, you have it in your head, that's not too shocking. Believe it or not, it's amazingly shocking to most of the world that there is far more water below the surface of the Earth than there is above the surface of the Earth. And that's fairly recent, that study, the proof of that study, how that came about is only within the last few decades, and it's super funny to me. Because it comes out in that very article, which I found and read, in the very article that revealed the research on the depths beneath the crust, they're like, clearly this plays some part alongside the accretion model. I was like, what are you talking about? There is no sustainable model by which this hydrated the Earth. And then you find all these reservoirs, not Christians, by the way, find all these reservoirs of water below the crust, and you go, oh yeah, clearly it fits in with that other model. Well, is that science, or is that something else at that point in time? Is that a refusal to confess that the Genesis account of the flood actually has some merit, right? But they won't do that. They won't do that. They won't even open the door to an ancient text that has repeatedly been proven to be reliable as having any explanation to the origins of this planet. That's the easy one. Here's the hard one. Io last week asked me about a question in class, and I put her off because I didn't fully hear the question at the time, but I believed that she was asking me how to respond in a personal way to someone about basically their struggles with the conflict between science and religion. So I went and found her after class, and I said, hey, could you repeat the question to me? I'm not sure I totally heard it. And I don't... She's not in the room right now, which is disappointing. But I don't think she'll mind, since she apparently asked the question during class. The question ultimately was that her son is coming home from school and asking difficult questions about the conflict between science and religion. And so that was helpful. I talked to her a little bit to try to understand the challenges a little bit more. And sure, those things are happening. And I said, look, there's no easy answers. You really have to take them one at a time and do your homework and see where you get. But the second one was ultimately what he was struggling with, her son is struggling with. That everybody at school, which I take to mean, his teachers, are telling him that religion is a social or a cultural construct. And I just want to ask you about that for a minute. How would you respond if somebody said religion is a cultural construct or a social construct? I tell you what, you're dead on. Dead on. I'm going to say as much in a few minutes, but I'm going to put your statement on pause so I can put it in context with some of my remarks in a few minutes. That's true. It might be a good response to the teacher who is saying that to him, but to the individual, the young man, right, he's really saying, you have taught me all my life that there is this thing called religion that is true. And there's a statement being made here, which I'm waiting for somebody to bring this point up. There's a statement being made here that says what? What does this sentence even mean?
That religion is based in people made it up, different cultures, different people groups throughout history have come up with it themselves.
Right, so it lacks what?
God is a creator, first of all.
Yeah.
An origin.
That's right. Some fundamental objective truth to it, right? It's a myth, is the phrase that I heard a voice, I didn't see it.
It lacks authority.
It lacks authority, right. Right. It lacks relevance, it lacks rationality, right? It's just a thing that came out to make culture and society convenient. So that's probably what he meant by it. I didn't get to ask he or she. I didn't get to ask the teacher, so I don't know. But I thought, I wonder what their point was, as I was kind of thinking through this after talking to her. And so I would like to go back and ask, but I think ultimately you're dead on in what you said. And the consequence of it being unmoored from tangible foundations means that it lacks relevance and authority. So I agree with all those statements. Now, go ahead, Bill.
I think just to make it more confusing, most religions of the world are cultural constructs.
Fantastic.
Even Christianity. I was going to say the same thing here. Really, how the secular world views religion, all religions are a cultural construct. Because when they do the data from religious systems, they group them all together. They don't recognize the fundamental differences of them. They just group them all together, especially when atheists are dealing with religion and it comes with the world. Well, when atheists deal with religion, they group them all together. And when the secular media deals with religion, they group them all together as if there's no difference between Christianity and Islam or Christianity and Buddhism. But if you look at the culture, in the culture, Christianity comes about the culture, followed from a man called Jesus Christ. When you look at Judaism comes about the culture, following a man called Moses. You see when you read the Old Testament and the New Testament, they have a lot of those cultural overtones in the text.
I don't disagree. There's some nuance there that I want to pick on, but I'm also aware that I have 4 minutes to finish this discussion. So,
I would ask, if it was my child, what did he mean by that? And see if he really knew what it meant, or was he just saying it? And then if he didn't know really what it meant, I would ask him if he could go back to the teacher and ask him to explain it so that he could explain it to his mom.
That, we're doing a great job covering, yes, by the way, all these are great answers. We're doing a great job talking about how the world views this statement, why they made this statement, what this statement might have been. I'm asking you, we're in a class called The Christian Mind. I am asking you, when faced with this challenge, what is your response at this point? Those were great answers to set a background. At this point forward, I want to know what you, as a Christian mind, say to this claim.
It would only be true if you didn't have a real relationship.
I love that answer. I don't have time. I love that answer. I think there's some necessary explanation that needs to go. And I don't know your name.
Eileen,
nice to meet you. I see you. I think there's some necessary explanation that needs to go with that relationship. But ultimately, if what we're saying there is a real God entering into real relationship that includes words that have been communicated to us, then absolutely, right? We are doing what is rational and real in that relationship. That is not a cultural construct. That is an individual essence, right? We are responding to each other according to God's spoken words that have been revealed to us through the scriptures.
I, as someone who believes the Bible is 100% true, the entire Bible, do not like to put my belief into the term religion, because religion is a social construct, is true for every other religion on this earth, because every other religion is not based on what I believe in this Bible as a whole, even though many religions claim to believe in parts of the Bible.
Yeah, I love it. I would challenge you all to keep thinking about this a little bit. This class is, and I did it again, I went to the back of the, what's the thing in the book we're supposed to be studying? I don't have enough faith to be an atheist. That's right, by Geisler. I went to the back of that and read a section because I'm preparing for the next couple of weeks. We're going to start tackling the problem of pain. And I'm dreading it, actually. It's just hard, and it's one of those ones I know I won't have definitive answers. That's why they call it the problem of pain, is because it remains a problem for us. And Teresa actually talked about it a little bit last Sunday night in one of the testimonies that she provided. And it's hard. But I'm going to tackle it in the next couple of weeks. And while studying that, I was in one of the appendix, and Geisler was working through a dialogue between a Christian and an atheist. There's a point here relevant to what you said, by the way. Was working between this dialogue, and it was so patronizing. You know, it was well, let me show you that you're wrong. I don't care about somebody else being wrong. I care about knowing God better today and tomorrow than I did yesterday. I care about applying him in ways that magnify him in my life. I care about coming alongside other people and doing exactly what Christ said his whole purpose and mission was in life when he gave his first sermon. And it was to set at liberty those who are in bondage, to heal those that are broken. And that only happens in durable truth. You give somebody a placebo, and it might make them feel psychologically better for a while, but it heals nothing. But you give them good medicine. You do your work and provide them the actuality of a cure. And that matters. Your Bible is not only a book that you can believe in, it's a book you can test and verify. To a great extent. There are miraculous things in it that would be challenging for us to test and verify outside of testimony, which we have. We certainly have more testimony for the miracles in the scriptures than we do the accretion model of hydration. One of the pivotal scientists we studied last week was Charles Pierce, The guy that came up with, or he didn't come up with it, he codified or systematized the scientific method. And he talked about it as a way to quantify or fix belief. And what he was opening the door to is, you might be wrong. Your research might be wrong. And you keep the door open to that, and you keep refining, and you keep pursuing truth. It was a fairly honest assessment. Well, given the veracity of scriptures and their discussion of oceans of water beneath the crust that could have been released in a global flood versus this accretion model of hydration, I know which one I'm going with. And the scriptures are the same way. They are not a cultural construct because they actually refine culture. They speak against culture. They go countercultural. What culture would have evidenced or would have come up with the scriptures that tell them don't pursue wealth above all things, serve others, that women are filled with a terrible dignity as image bearers of Christ, and men are meant to lead whether they want to or not. No matter how challenging it is, no matter how humiliating it is, we have a wrong image of leadership, and so we always think about it as the opposite of humiliation, but it is often humiliation. Put your hands to the thing that nobody else wants to touch. Set your time and your heart and your resources toward the thing that nobody else sees sufficient value in, but you must do it because it's necessary. Those are countercultural ideas. They are anti-pragmatic. Spend everything for the soul that is going to hell, and you get nothing from it. Well, in an earthly web, earthly calculus, I guess, right? It's countercultural in every way. And it's not cultural in the sense that it's a myth because it's verifiable. It's one of the most verifiable things that we have. There is no history book that has greater accreditation than your Bible. Pursue God with your mind. Please don't listen to me rambling here. Bill Daniels, does the security stuff, and he was away from church, and this week he shared with me that sometimes when he's away from church, he flips through the cameras. I'm like, that's really creepy, Bill. But he flips through the camera things, right? And he's like, yeah, I checked my boys to make sure they weren't sleeping in class. Stalker. And then I sat on your class, and I stayed there because you're entertaining. You walk around, and you wave your hands, and I can tell you, I can't hear you, but I can see. And apparently he texted his son and says, well, Mr. Mahoney seems pretty excited. To which he got the response, as always. I don't want you coming in here for the spectacle. Please, develop a Christian mind. Not as a discipline that improves you, per se. I'm not looking for self-help and improvement here. Your God is greater. Your God is more relevant. Your God is more meaningful. What you have in Christ is so infinitely more valuable than you currently suspect that it is. There is no book, no matter how much we love it, and you see me, one of the greatest marital struggles I have is the number of books I buy. My wife doesn't like it. And we don't have enough bookshelves or corners of the house to stack them in any longer. So my way around that, by the way, is Kindle, just so you know. But anyway, I love books, but there isn't a single one of them that gets it right. They come close. They speak about truth. They describe God in good ways that are helpful and constructive and protective, that we don't wander off in areas and in ways that we should not, as other men have so many times. But they are insufficient. Whatever box you have God in your life, wherever you are separated from Him in any way, you're wrong, and you need to be pursuing your good and great God. That is the point of this class. If you do not take it on as a mental discipline, the pursuit of your God and all the value that is in Him, oh, you are rejoicing the evil one. You have believed a lie. And you have settled. C.S. Lewis quote, right? You've settled for playing in the streets when somebody offered you a vacation at the beach. That's a paraphrase of a C.S. Lewis quote. Okay, let's get the real class started here. We covered the basis of the scientific revolution starting at Copernicus. We covered the antagonists of the scientific revolution last week, beginning with Charles Darwin and moving to Thomas Huxley. I threw a salute into Bertrand Russell, but I'm actually going to mostly pick up there. But as it pertains to today's class, I need to fill in a little gap or a little reminder from last week. We're going to cover the consequence of ideas is where we're at. It's on page 4 if you have your notes. We're going to cover the consequence of ideas, this idea of a conflict, an established, accepted, verifiable, substantive conflict between religion and science. That idea has had amazing consequences. And that's where I want to pick up today, but it is important that you catch this from last week. Charles Darwin's theories, this is not a quote from him, it's a quote by others about his theories, just so you know. Charles Darwin's theories purported to support modest humanism. And they don't mean like, you know, like bounded humanism. They mean humanism that is modest, humanism that is humble. Does everybody basically understand the idea of humanism? Somebody give me a 2 or 3 word definition for humanism.
But humans are born naturally good.
That is part of it. Do you remember last week what we talked about with materialism? All things are just material in motion being modified over time. That's materialism. So if that's materialism, then humanism is replacing some of that materialism, although it's actually augmenting that materialism, then what would we say humanism is?
To make decisions for yourself.
The agency of the human is really all that is left for us, right? In a materialistic world, the only thing that provides deterministic agency is humans. So if we don't do it, it ain't getting done. So that's good. So this is a modest humanism. I don't know how you blend those two words together, but nonetheless, purported to support modest humanism. And then this quote is from a book I've got at the bottom of the page there, 6 Modern Myths. Short book, very easy to read, highly recommend it to you. The use of the Copernican Revolution as a metaphor for modest and realistic humanism seems to have first gained ground during the Enlightenment of the 18th century. The 19th century joined it to Darwin's evolutionary metaphor and put man in his place on Earth, just as astronomy had put him in his place in the heavens. The insinuation here is that religion and you know, from an astronomy or cosmological perspective, the geocentric view of the world, that religion ultimately establishes man in a central, as a central figure in all of reality, and therefore bespeaks an arrogance, or suggests, or indicates, or requires an arrogance that is unbelievable. And science has come to put men in their place, and we first did it. Galileo first did it with the heliocentric view of the universe. We already discussed how that was false. And Darwin did it from a biology and genetics perspective. Not the culminating creation of a divine intelligence, but an accident, an improbable, matter of fact, the most improbable accident that has ever happened, resulting in you. So it's necessarily humble. It's necessarily modest. It's necessarily self-deprecating. That's their statement. But you'll see as we move forward, the consequence of their ideas was the exact opposite. And in fact, a quote from Darwin, "Man's godlike intellect has penetrated into the movements and constitution of the solar system. Man's godlike intellect has penetrated into the movements and constitution of the solar system. I'm going to finish up with Bertrand Russell here in this scientific antagonist section. If Charles Darwin was something like Calvin was the word I was looking for. All I could think of was Institutes of the Christian Religion. If Luther and Calvin are the theologians on which we have based much of church theology in the last 500 years, then Charles Darwin would be the theologian that established doctrine theology, systematized it for the scientific revolution. John Draper, Andrew White, and Thomas Huxley in particular, as we discussed last week, are the people that picked that up and ignited the world with those humble ideas that Charles Darwin had. Bertrand Russell, if you have your notes, you'll see the quote, "Britain's best known 20th century atheist, wrote a significant book, quite good, I think I'll say, called The History of Philosophy. He has written a great number of books, but his History of Philosophy is one that's still prevalent in universities today. His reputation for being against God is also somewhat notorious, as you can see from that quote, "Britain's best known 20th century atheist." And he wrote much that was critical of the Christian religion and the Bible. Nonetheless, I challenge you all to read and consider his insights in chapter 12 of his small book, Science and the Modern World. It's an e-book that's available either free or on Project Gutenberg free on Project Gutenberg or $1.99 on Amazon. When I say small book, I literally mean like half an inch, right? Not an inch or 2 inches or 3 inches or some of the other books you've seen me bring in here. It's a small book, and it's interesting. It should make you angry, and I hope that it does, and I hope that it provokes you to think about things more clearly and understand what the consequence of some of the modern ideas are. A summary of Russell's book by a guy named Michael Ruse. Let there be, I'm using him because he has really been the modern prophet, if you will, of the scientific revolutions, the ideas that Huxley popularized across the world and that originally came from Darwin's theory. So a summary of Russell's book on science in the modern world, Michael Ruse says, "Let there be no mistake, this is a war which has been won decisively by science, a result for which all decent people should be profoundly grateful. With the death of religion goes superstition and oppression and hatred. With the success of science comes understanding and freedom and love." That was written, I'm not sure, I'd have to look at the date on the book, which might be in the reference. Hold, please. Nope. I quoted another source, and I didn't bring the book with me today. But he only lived between 1809 and 1882. So we're a long way from him. You see all those posters out on people's lawns? Love is everything. Science is true. My neighbor has one up, and he knows that it drives me nuts. He puts it as close to my property line as he can. And then he acts like a raving, hateful lunatic.
This the whole point of the religion is a cultural construct. The consequence of that idea is that you can live however you want because it's just the social taboos that religion is putting on you. If you can just shuck religion, you can have that freedom.
Absolutely, but I will not be sucked back into that discussion because I'm running short on time and Doreen already mocked me for not finishing my notes. I just want you to see, again, consequence of ideas, right? Darwin's ideas, whether he meant them to or not, right? And by the way, he had a responsibility
to deal with the consequence of his ideas. We're going to talk about James Pierce just briefly for the sake of time, but James Pierce, his ideas got out of his hand. Right, this guy that came up with the scientific method, he ended up forming what was called pragmatism at the time, which basically means if it's practical, if it's effective to the end that we intend, then it doesn't matter whether it's right or wrong, it's good. Right? So we take goodness and we define goodness by whether it's practical or not. And that got out of control. He didn't mean it to be like that. And so he coined a new phrase and he wrote a bunch of books saying, I am not in support of pragmatism, as this buddy of mine who I was at Harvard with, you know, we had some discussions, we kind of formed these ideas, and he went off onto this like rampant pragmatism. No God, hate God, nothing about God. Let me talk about value. He talked about it from a values perspective, this other guy. And Pierce was like, that is not what I meant. Let me tell you what I meant, and let me give you a different word for it so that you have it. And he called it pragmaticism, because, you know, harder to say, and therefore you couldn't mistakenly say it, right? He called it pragmaticism. But he took pains to say, these were not my ideas, and you have gone in a place that has consequences that I am not willing to support. Darwin had a responsibility to do these same things. And I will withhold further judgment about why he allowed it to happen, but the truth is, he allowed it to happen and has supported it conveniently behind people like Huxley and others. Ideas have a consequence. Look where we're at. The ideas that we are swimming in today so that we don't even see them because they're in the water all around us started with an attack on the veracity of Scripture and the reality of God. Consequence of... thought I heard a beginning of a word. Somebody say something? Jean, is that you?
No, it was her Diet Coke.
Oh. I know I run my mouth. I try to be sensitive to interruptions. The Coke was a new one, though. Let it never be said that I'm, you know, bulldoze people. I even give up for a Coke. Consequence of ideas is, I stole that shamelessly from, shamefully me, from a book by R.C. Sproul. It's on A History of Philosophy. It's a much smaller book than Bertrand Russell's, which is, you know, that big. You know, Sproul's is that big. Again, highly recommend that you read the book. It helps you think. It helps you think. More than that, it builds your faith. I guess when I say helps you think, I hope I'm being clear about that. I want you to have your faith built up, and I want it to encourage you and sustain you. I want you to see the glory that you are robed in the truthfulness of Christ, in the historicity of Christ, in the imminence of Christ, that He is with you. That all of His recorded history in the Scriptures are Him unwinding the curse so that He could be with His people. That's what I mean when I say I want you to think. These ideas have consequences. Sproul's book talks about those consequences through a history of philosophy. I'm not doing that so much. I'm specifically interacting with the scientific revolution here. The scientific revolution eroded man's confidence in the divine regard. How often have I said to you, I want you comforted in Christ, and so I need you to think. Do you see where it comes from? This isn't just me. It is me. It's a conviction that I've had for several decades now. But it's not just me. It's well documented that the scientific revolution, by antagonists and protagonists alike, eroded man's confidence in the divine regard. I'm trying to figure out where the quote came from. I mean, I know what book it came from, but I want to make sure it's the right person. Yeah, Draper's book, the one that was actually used to provoke that debate, the Oxford debates that we talked about last week, where, you know, drove the definitive nail in the superiority of science over religion and made the best example of religious science and theology look embarrassing. That was kind of the news line for that, even though that's not at all what happened. Draper's book, more than Darwin's theories, were what was discussed there. History of the Conflict Between Religion and Science. And in that book, on two separate pages, the first sentence of this is from page 175, and the second one is from page 8.
of what consequence is man? After talking about the history of conflict between science and religion, he basically said science has stepped on the scene and has taken over the truth. We now know. We don't live in the dark ages. We don't have what Bertrand Russell said, right? You should be thankful. All decent people should be profoundly grateful. With the death of religion goes superstition and oppression and hatred. I'll tell you what else what goes. The confidence in the divine regard. You understand that phrase? Divine regard? What does that mean? What is the divine regard? It's important. Come on, this isn't a trick question.
Romans 1:10. They did not regard God.
That would be the opposite. You're talking about our regard for God. That absolutely, 100%, that is not what this sentence means.
How God looks at man.
That this is God's regard for man.
Psalm 8, right?
Yep. This is God's, super good, but mirror that. Of what consequence is man, his pleasure or his pain? To dethrone the earth from her central dominating position, he's interacting with that idea that, you know, once geocentrism was thrown out and heliocentrism was proved, that clearly religion was debunked. To dethrone the earth from her central dominating position, to give her many equals and not a few superiors, seemed to diminish her claim upon the divine regard. And I only use him because Draper's book was the source that has been used for over 200 years to support the claim of the Dark Ages, that whole period of the growth of religion, right? All the work that Christ had done and accomplished and the explosion of Christianity across the globe. In modern textbooks, that's called the Dark Ages of superstition and hatefulness and the disregard of the dignity of God's image bearers. That's how it's been written down. And it's Draper's book that was most often cited. And White, Draper and White. And so I gave you that quote, right? The guy that started that understood what the consequence of his ideas were. And the consequence is God doesn't care. God does not care about you. Or if he does, he cares about you in some marginal way. You have been put in an order of all things, and compared to other things, according to Darwin, you're just an accident. So how important do you think you are to the divine regard? Versus the majesty of a sun or a star or a squid or, I don't know, I don't even want to guess. That's one consequence. Another consequence is the scientific method is the tyranny of empiricism. If you can't test it, it's not true. Empiricism, in the way that Bertrand Russell and many that follow in his footsteps mean it, is that if I can't sense it, I can't know it. In what this is only partially true. I keep drawing two circles on the board and putting natural in one and supernatural in the other. Where does God primarily reside? In which of those two circles?
Everywhere.
Supernatural, right? I'm just using simple catechism here, right? What is God? God is spirit, right? I don't mean that everything in the natural order is not touched by him, doesn't speak to him. Romans 1, 20 and 21, the invisible things of him, why are they invisible? Because he's supernatural. The invisible things of Sam from the creation of the world, that's the natural order. I'm going to get confused if I keep commentating on my quotation, but the invisible things of him from the creation of the world are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made. What is he saying? That natural order speaks to the supernatural nature of God. So that they are without excuse, because that when they knew God, they glorified him not as God, neither were thankful, but became stupid, vain, empty, futile, worthless, with no end in their thinking, and their foolish hearts were darkened. But this empiricism, this tyranny of empiricism,
excises supernatural. You are no longer permitted to have communication about the supernatural. To do that is superstition. To do that is foolishness. And yet the very book that we use to establish the criteria for what we know about the supernatural has over and over and over again been attested to by archaeology, by science, by observational art, if you will. And I call it art because you never know. Read the same scientists. It is difficult to approach something without bias. I have this experience. I see this thing. We all see this thing. It is empirically demonstrated. But what does it mean? And what caused it? And to what end does it move? And those are hard questions. And yet we look at the scriptures and they are the most reliable thing that we have. And they have over and over again been authenticated, even in the face of criticism and this will never happen and you'll never be able to prove this. Wait 30 years, and we dig something else up, and sure enough, we find that it's true. Or we discover something else in the heavens, and we find that it's true there. You want me to believe this that you have no reasonable mechanism for, no attestation, no testimony, no eyewitness. And yet we've got documents that have been verified for 3,000 years old. That sentence was busted, but you know what I mean. And we won't believe it. And yet the guy that came up with the scientific method said this is all about observational science fixing belief, because he was humble enough to realize that given observational science, given the scientific method, you could still be wrong. And so he called it fixing belief, and I love it. Basically said, if you can't sense it, you can't know it. And yet I stand before you and say that I could spend the remainder of the day quoting from the scriptures verses that talk about God being with you, near you, in you, caring for you, sacrificing his son for you, ready to walk through every valley with you in a way that yields such light and such joy that there is never a time when thanksgiving and gratitude and praise are not the right response, so much so that to fail to do it is literally a sin that causes damnation and punishment for God. What was the sin of the Israelites? We say all the disobediences. That's fine, but that's not what the scripture said. It says ingratitude, grumbling. What have you done? You have believed that because you're having a difficult time seeing God move in your life in ways that appeal to your five senses, that the truths that have been repeatedly attested to in the written documentation that he provided us and has preserved for millennia is untrue, or is not true in the way that you think it is. It's true, but it's true in some other way. Well, what other way? There is not a single person in this room that is not guilty of this. I am not. I am passionate about this because I see that in every day's work, I believe the lie. That God is not there, that he is not infinitely in control, that he is not caring for me, that he does not intend to pour all that I need into every situation to glorify him. And it may hurt, and it may be challenging, but I have all that I need in him. Not only to do what needs to be done, but to do it in a way that evidences God's glory with gratitude and praise, not manufactured, but real. One of those joys that sprinkles out of the heart and causes song or noise without word because you can't find the right word to do it. Something like what you felt, if it wasn't sheer panic, something like what you felt when your first child came. Or when your spouse actually said yes, and you can't imagine why she would do that. I can't flip it around because that just doesn't work for me, but you get the idea. Something like that joy. Charles S. Peirce, right, the king of empiricism, because he was the guy that codified the scientific method, which is all about empiricism. Charles Peirce is credited with codifying the scientific method during a transatlantic voyage when he was finally given time to think about it.
free from some of his other responsibilities. He defended the superiority of the scientific method over other methods of overcoming doubt and fixing belief. That's a direct quote. Right? He continued to defend the superiority of this scientific method over other methods of overcoming doubt and fixing belief. And then a quote from him on in a paper called The Fixation of Belief. Above all, this is a little pointy-headed, but I do think it's worth going through, so just bear with me. Above all, let it be considered that there... above all, let it be considered that what is more wholesome than any particular belief is integrity of belief, and that to avoid looking into the support of any belief from a fear that it may turn out rotten is quite as immoral as it is disadvantageous. The person who confesses that there is such a thing as truth, which is distinguished from falsehood simply by this, that if acted on, it will carry us to the point we aim at and not astray. And then, though convinced of this, dares not know the truth and seeks to avoid it, is in a sorry state of mind indeed. I don't exactly know what Pierce's religious philosophies were. I suspect I would not have agreed with him on many things, but he did write an awfully interesting paper called A Neglected Argument for the Reality of God, in which he ridiculed many Christian ideas, but he did make an attempt to argue for the reality of God and the need to pursue him through these very methods, to apply this very integrity of truth to the pursuit of God. I already told you he struggled with the consequences of his own ideas, with the pragmaticism thing. I'm not going to say much more about that. So, eroded man's confidence in the divine regard, severed the supernatural realm from man entirely through this tyranny of empiricism, created a mechanistic view of all that exists. Mechanistic science. And ultimately that means if we can't conceive of the machine that can do it, then it can't be done. You're absolutely right, but back to Bertrand Russell's quote, right? Science and religion are at war, and his philosophies have funded... I mean, that's what has been taught. That's not what's true. And that's wonderful. I'm not there yet, but I am getting there, right? When I get to a quote from a guy named Lauren Isley, you'll know that I'm ready for your quote, okay? I am going to get there. mechanistic science, anti-supernaturalism. How does that play in? Same discussion that we were just having. I got all passionate. I came out here. I said, I believe the lie and it worked, right? What is that? That's me saying, I don't know how to get through this valley right now. I don't see a path by my own resources, my own strength, my own intellect. I can't call Bill up and just have him bail me out, right? Like, I don't know how he's going to make it work. Right? So, I despair. Gratitude is the farthest thing from me. I'm frustrated. I'm grim. I'm stoic. But what am I doing? I'm looking for mechanism in the natural world to do the very thing that God said, stop. And pray and be settled and rejoice, and you will see that I am God. I never know where I'm going to get in the class anymore. I feel like, I don't know why. I feel like I regularly speak on a time thing and I do fine, but you guys are killing me. I have been thinking about this class for a number of months now. I've been thinking about this problem of pain that I'm about to move to. I've been thinking about all the stuff that I'm teaching you today. And one of the things, as I studied the scriptures, and because I always want to go back, I don't want philosophy, I want scripture. And one of the things that I have been really impressed with over the last weeks and months is simply this. We don't see God work much in our lives for two reasons. Don't ask. When we ask amiss. And two, we don't believe. And while Christ, you know, study of Luke. I still don't understand why anybody from my small group comes to this class. Why would you subject yourself to me twice in 1 week? But nonetheless, on Tuesday nights, nope, Thursday nights, we've been studying through Luke, and I have just been so impressed with the abundance of mercy that Christ poured out while he was here. So much so that John the Baptist said, "Are you the Messiah, the one that was to bring judgment and mercy?" And Christ's response was, "Yes, I am the Messiah." And then he just poured out radical mercy in the form of crazy miracles, crazily indulgent, abundant mercies and miracles. But over and over again during Christ's ministry, he says, "I'm not going to do that in your life because you don't believe. You aren't trusting." And so if it's in your head that I'm a nut job standing up here talking about God's mercy because you're not seeing it in your life, I got to ask you those two things. Are you asking so that you can be faithful to the Lord in the obedience of thanksgiving and gratitude, sharing his light with the rest of the world, and with your family, and with your church, and even in the mirror to yourself? Are you asking in those reasons, and are you believing? Help thou my unbelief. Forget if. You know that you suffer from a mechanistic view of God's goodness. And you've been taught that it's okay. And I'm going to be very careful here about systematic theologies that we have established to fence the goodness of God from those that would abuse it and talk about, well, my gift this and my gift that and healing this and healing that. And all they're really looking for is to establish the authority of man. And dead on, I'm not challenging any of those. But even our theology has gotten plastic. God works in this box. We are after the, you know, Acts speaks about the formation of the church, and we call that this period. Apostolic was what I was looking for. Thank you. Church age is also good, though. I hadn't thought of that one. Right? We are after that age, and God works in this box. Oh, does he? I understand why those borders are set up for safety. But when you are grasping for God, I'm not convinced those borders are helpful to you. Your God is profligate in his mercy. Those are words that generally shouldn't be put together, so please don't repeat that too often. Your God is exceedingly abundant, more merciful than you can imagine, and more imminent in your life, more interested in what you do. He could not be less interested in the mechanics of your life, in the sense that he's not limited by them, nor is he limited by the box that we put them in, the post-apostolic age. Nor does he care what you think about eschatology, in the sense that we're discussing it here today, right now. Again, please be careful. Right, I waved my systematic theology book around and told you how many copies I have and how I give them to people, and I love them so much. Please take me as I intend. Another consequence is the arrogance of man. Not the humility of man, but the arrogance of man, the tyranny of pragmatism. Whatever is useful is good, and it doesn't matter whether there's a standard outside of that. Galileo exploited this changed status of the earth when he had his mouthpiece, Salviati. I told you about this guy before. We say this: we seek to ennoble and perfect the earth when we strive to make it like the celestial bodies and, as it were, place it in heaven. Darwin's theories made white males the apex of nature. How do I know that? Because eugenics is the word I was looking for, right? Eugenics were a logical consequence of the scientific community, and I shared several of them with you last week when we talked about it. The people that first picked up Darwin's ideas and ran with them, eugenics. Racism is a necessary consequence of it. Sexism is a necessary consequence of it. Darwin's theories made white males the apex of nature. Which clearly I'm not supporting. I don't know why I feel the need to say that in this community. You should all know me well enough. But I just want to say, do not support that. Undismayed by the empire of chance, man determines to preserve a mind free from the wanton tyranny that rules his outward life. Did you hear that? Undismayed by the empire of chance, meaning there's nothing out there but chance. That's all that there is random chance. And we stand stoically in the face of that, undismayed, and we determine to preserve a mind free from the wanton tyranny that rules our outward life. We determine that we will be free of the tyranny out there. Proudly defiant of the irresistible forces that tolerate for a moment his knowledge and his condemnation. I'm not going to finish the quote. The basic idea is there's nothing. We're here. We get to determine everything while we're here. It's our minds against everything else. There's just wanton chance and reckless tyranny and chaos out there. And you're only going to be here for a short period of time and then nothing. And so you get to rule for the period of time that you're here. And if you don't do it well, you miss your chance. It's all up to you. That's the consequence of those scientific ideas. Historicism, though, actual historicism. Like if you study history, if you go back and look at the evidence, historicism corrects this Huxleyan evangelism. It undoes this false war between science and religion, and the broad brush painting of religion as superstition and hatefulness. A man named Alfred Whitehead, who was an amazing mathematician, I was unfamiliar with him until I started this studying, but he did a series of lectures at Harvard called the Lowell Lectures. You can find them online, look at them in the footnotes. And while I can't succinctly quantify Whitehead's religious beliefs, I think he was a panentheist, for those of you that are theologically oriented out there, or systematically oriented out there. I think he was a panentheist, but I can't quite say. He certainly co-authored Principia Mathematica with Bertrand Russell, Britain's best-known 20th century atheist. So this guy hung out with people I don't like. There can be no living, and these are some quotes from his book, or his lectures, excuse me. There can be no living science unless there is a widespread instinctive conviction in the existence of an order of things, and in particular, of an order of nature, capital O, order, capital N, nature. When he was talking about, he was addressing them as a scientist, he was addressing scientists. And what he was saying is there's no ability to do science meaningfully. There's no point in doing science meaningfully unless you believe that all of the natural things that we see in the world are ordered. There is an order of things. They are sustained in it and intended on it, and they will achieve what they were intended to do. Not just matter, not just humanism, not just pragmatism, but this order. And in particular, one that orders these things. Regarding this conviction, Whitehead writes, there seems but one source for its origin. It must come, he's talking about the idea that there's an order and therefore we can study it and have a fruitful study. If we study it and it keeps changing underneath of us and dissolving or deteriorating into chaos, what's the point? But if we can come to an understanding of it and then use that and depend on the systematic, dependable order of those things, then we have a shot at improving things like medicine. Or law, or so many other things. And so he says that pursuit of science, that conviction that it's meaningful and purposeful and valuable, there seems but one source for its origin. It must come from the medieval insistence on the rationality of God. The very thing you were taught was irrational and at war with science. He here says is the basis of that science, and is a matter of fact, a necessary basis of science. On the rationality of God. Notice how he got more into his lecture there. probably like me, right? Started off with the order of nature, capital O, capital N, and here he gets to the rationality of God, conceived as with the personal, or as with personal energy of Jehovah, and with the rationality of a Greek philosopher. I am unclear from reading large segments of his lectures whether he was actually supporting the medieval concepts in a God creator. I know that he saw that historically and was definitely affirming the fundamental necessity of that conviction for the pursuit of science. And his whole lecture speaks to that. The faith in the possibility of science generated antecedently to the development of modern scientific theory is an unconscious derivative from medieval theology. That's a mouthful of words, but he basically says, if we had not believed in God, we never would have gotten to where we're at with science. It would have been dead before it was born.
On this topic about the order of things, it seems like it is a concept that, it's a core concept for the Christian and then also for the atheist. How is it, like for the Christian, we can say, yes, God is in all things and holds all things together. And so, yes, there is order just because God is the order of things. And then for the atheist, they would take that and say, everything is mechanistic because there is some type of order. How did we get to the point where, I guess, the atheist kind of took that into their side of...
This sounds glib, and I'm not trying to be glib, but and maybe I've, matter of fact, I probably should take that as a good commentary on my ability to convey well what I've been trying to convey over the last 3 weeks. That is exactly what I've been trying to do over the last 3 weeks, though, is talk to you about how early ideas, and I've been deliberately trying to leave off my commentary on those ideas as we go through, how early ideas open the door to the lie that there is a conflict between observational science and the truth of God, how that was picked up by men that wished to shake their fist in the face of God and promulgated for two centuries. And then now, in the late 1800s, early 1900s, when Whitehead spoke, there began to be an opportunity for the history to be set right. And these same men of science are now saying there's no way to actually view these things. You painted them as two discrete observational, or two discrete camps, I guess I'll say. But this very man who did not love God or did not trust God according to his word, but instead believed that God and matter had some relationship that he couldn't quite express. That's what it means to be panentheist, and I know I didn't explain that, but that's what it means to be like that. The idea that God is in everything, kind of, you know, Hindu type thing, except the panentheist adds the opportunity or the possibility of God also being somehow personal in that. Distant, removed, with matter intervening, but somehow a personal God that has intention. So I really am challenging that fundamental. Does the world actually see God differently than we do? My response is they do not. They choose to close their eyes to the very evidence that would draw them to an intelligent creator and a personal God. And that's a cultural construct. That is us saying we will not serve God, right? That is Romans 1, 20 and 21. When they saw God, they did not glorify him as God, neither were thankful, and their foolish hearts were darkened. Don't tank me, dude. I got 10 minutes.
I think one point that you're making along the way that is particularly salient for us is that when when an expert in a field blurs the line of their expertise and then launches their authority outward and upward in every direction, that's the big place to pump the brakes and say, hold on a second, you don't get to have a say on this, this, this. Right? So a big issue we have in this concept is the idea that you wanted to look at progressive biology, you wanted to look at it, and then now you want to make moral claims on everything in life connected on something that you have put together and even didn't even necessarily do that correctly. And I think that's the space for sort of the contrast that we have from the truth of Scripture, is that Scripture permeates everything perfectly. Right? So everything in life that God has laid out for us fits perfectly, that I can both trust that He controls all things, creator of all things, and He cares about my morality, and He cares about salvation and sin and holiness. Does that sort of make sense?
Yes. So those couple of quotes I gave you from Alfred Whitehead basically talked about there is no such thing as science that is not predicated first on the truth that is God, an ordered creator who is communicating himself in a rational way through that which is created, holding it together, maintaining it toward the end that he had. That is the necessary predicate for the endeavor of science. And again, not a Christian. Just seeing what's there. There's a whole intelligent design thing, craze, right now. Those people are, many of them, not Christians. Not Christians at all. They're just saying this doesn't work without an intelligent designer. Whether he's involved or not, whether he's a clockmaker that got it started or whatever, they go all different places. They do not know God. But they see. They see the necessity of the supernatural intervention in the created order. We don't work without something else. And they see that. Now, to combat that, because science was losing ground in the early 1900s, see Great Awakenings, see global revival, because they were losing ground in the early 1900s, scientists moved to block it. And you get scientists and philosophers like Hume that came back and he was like, oh, you're all talking about this thing gets set in order and it has this purpose and, you know, the cause and the event are related. And so he just severed that. For reasons I'm not clear, you talk about authority, like why he was able to speak to this, I don't know. But Hume came along and he said, the event and the effect, or the effect and the event, are distinct. We don't need to talk about what caused this. We can look at things as, hey, there's print on the screen. Whiteboard. I think I know that as an engineer. How did it get there? What caused it? Doesn't matter, it's there. And it's material, right? So it must have just gotten there. And the fact that he spells words, boy, did we get lucky on that one. Separated event from effect. And while Hume is often laughed at in the scientific community, his philosophies are still amazingly prevalent. And you see echoes of his philosophies in so much that we do as law and politics and community and science and education and religion. I can be religious because it makes me feel better and it works for me and it helps me live a better life and it keeps me controlled and it keeps me off of having to take drugs that would be expensive in, you know, medical insurance and a drain on society. And so it's just good that I'm religious. It doesn't matter how I got here. It doesn't matter whether it's true. Me being able to be here in this way and having a beneficial effect, that's all that matters. And I used religion as one, but how about gender? Doesn't matter. I mean, what is more unscientific than the whole transgender thing? You are chemically male or female. You are hormonally male or female. You are structurally male or female. And you can
throw in other hormones and you can alter structure, but you can't change that chemical thing that's a part of every cell in your body. And yet we say it's absolutely a thing that you get to override that. What is that? That's Hume's philosophy. The event and the effect don't have to have any relationship whatsoever. And it creeps into our Christian thinking again. I don't have time to embellish that, but see previous commentary, or hear previous commentary. Lauren Isley was a prolific and influential scientist. I told you I'd get here. I got to do it. Influential scientist that wrote between 1950 and 1970. Listen to this. A PhD anthropologist, he received 33 honorary degrees, as well as the Phi Beta Kappa Award for the best science book, Darwin's Century, wherein he states, very reluctantly, in one of those strange permutations of which history yields occasional rare examples, it is the Christian world which finally gave birth in a clear, articulate fashion to the experimental method of science itself. And so that's a, I'm going to end with a Bible statement, but that's a great quote from a non-Christian scientist. It says this idea that there is a revolution or a conflict between science and religion is garbage. I want every last one of you to know that you can serve your God with your mind wide awake to all that is true, and you will never regret your confidence in the God revealed through scriptures. As a matter of fact, you will grow in your confidence. You will grow in your capacity for obedience. You will grow in the comfort that you find in a God who is immanent in all that he is and does, who has spent all of our history undoing the damage that we did to our relationship with him so that he might be with us. And he has written lavishly across the created order of who he is and what he is like, and how much he cares for each of us. Acts 17:25 and 28, since he himself gives to all mankind life and breath and everything, in him we live and move and have our being. You say that's so familiar. Why do you read it? Because there is nothing materialistic or mechanistic or humanistic in it. But it puts God at the center of every breath that you take. It doesn't happen because he forgot to turn it off. It happens because he speaks it into you, because he cares about you at that moment, because he is drawing you to yourself. Because he is being merciful to the sinner to give them another breath and another breath and another breath and another chance to confess him. Your scriptures don't make much sense. They sound like mantra unless you understand much of what we have discussed over the last 3 weeks. And you're so used to hearing them and so used to not thinking about them that they are cheapened in your heart and mind. They play little part as currency in the economy of your life. And yet you are each equipped with a surplus of that currency that is unbelievable. It is more than enough for all that you have and need. And I wish I had another hour, and I'm sure you wish I didn't. So I'll close.